art, politics, and the romantic imagination.
Beethoven, I think, believed very strongly in the individual. On the other hand, the message, if there is a message, in the Ninth Symphony is very strongly a message of human brotherhood.
That's Harvey Sachs. We talked to him about his book, The Ninth, Beethoven and the World in 1824. We'll also play an interview from our archives with Mark Lamster about his book, Master of Deception. It's about Peter Paul Rubens and his secret diplomatic career. We first aired it in March of this year. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Can you write a whole book for the general public about one piece of music? Yes, if you're writing about Beethoven's stirring Ninth Symphony, which was always about more than the music. As Anthony Tomasini wrote in his New York Times review of our guest Harvey Sachs's book about the Ninth, for generations, the symphony with its choral finale espousing universal brotherhood has been the work of choice to solemnize a peace treaty. But Beethoven never pegged the piece to any particular political philosophy. Instead, through the music, he called upon the listener to attain a higher, more heroic state of being, one free of the prisons of the mind that society and its enforcers tried to impose. Harvey Sachs first became inspired by the Ninth Symphony when he was a child, growing up in Cleveland with its great symphony orchestra. When Sachs was 12 years old, he asked for a recording of the Ninth as a birthday present. He was attracted to the power and excitement of the music, but more than that, Beethoven was for the young Sachs an example of someone who lived as he wanted to. I can remember at the same age choosing the motto, "To thine own self be true." The individual in his own right was an idea born by Romanticism, and Beethoven was present at that birth.
Beethoven is often seen as the sort of first romantic in music, certainly, although at the time there were people like E.T.A. Hoffmann and other writers who considered even Haydn and Mozart to have been romantics because of the personal expression in their music. But Beethoven we see today as sort of the bridge between the classical period and the romantic period in music. And Beethoven was seen by his immediate successors, by the people, artists, not just musicians, but other artists of the musician of the generation that followed his, as a sort of fundamental figure with respect to the notion of the creative genius, the person who could break rules and live in a sort of untrammeled way and be himself entirely. So this is connected. I connected in the book, then I mention Thomas Carlyle's essay on the great man and that sort of thing. And of course, Beethoven would have been repelled by part of that, but I think he would have agreed with a lot of it.
And that's the idea that it is the great men of history who move history forward, very different from some of our modern notions of history, which is the history of everyday life.
Yes, Fernand Braudel has changed that approach almost entirely in historiography and so on. But, of course, we do still study events and the people who were decisive in moving those events. Beethoven, I think, believed very strongly in the individual. On the other hand, the message, if there is a message, in the Ninth Symphony is very strongly a message of human brotherhood across races, religions, nations, etc., etc., etc. That the statement in the poem by Friedrich von Schiller that Beethoven used, chopped up and used as a text for his last, the finale of the Ninth Symphony, states, "All men will be brothers." And this was very important to Beethoven. On the other hand, he didn't think that that would happen very soon. And as we know, unfortunately, it still hasn't happened.
In this idea of the romantic philosophy and the individual, make the connection here for us. What is it about romanticism that elevates the individual?
Well, I think you have to go back and talk about the precursors of romanticism, assuming that we could talk about movements and, you know, pigeonhole them. But I see romanticism as the grandchild of the Enlightenment and the child of the French Revolution. The thing that's particularly interesting and curious, I would say, about the Ninth Symphony is that it was being written in Vienna in the early 1820s at precisely the time at which Metternich was perfecting the first modern police state. So here is Beethoven, who by that time was completely deaf and living in a sort of internal exile, exile from human society in a way, writing this idealistic tribute to the human ability to transcend itself, and writing it in exactly the place and at exactly the time when the opposite was taking place. Following the Enlightenment, following the failed, at least in the short run, French Revolution, the idea, the repressive nature of all the European governments at that time, the need of these rulers who had almost been deposed, and in some cases had been deposed, to try to impose once again the authority of whatever their national church was, of divine right, etc., etc. I don't think they or anybody else really believed that at the time, but they imposed that on their subjects because they wanted to return to the order of pre-revolutionary and pre-Napoleonic Europe. And so there's Beethoven living in his bubble, writing something that is completely at odds with the tenor of the times.
He was really a revolutionary idealist in some ways.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think the idea of Beethoven as a radical democratic type, I think, is probably wrong. As far as we know, Beethoven probably, if he had clear-cut ideas about political systems, I think he would have approved most likely of a sort of philosopher king, a benevolent ruler who would treat all his subjects well and rule wisely, not in a sort of democracy as his somewhat later contemporary Tocqueville described it in America.
Mm-hmm. It reminded me, as I was reading your book, Harvey Sachs, the Ninth, that it reminded me of some of the Romantic poets of the latter part of the 19th and the turn of the 20th century in Germany. There was Stefan George, who was a great, great figure before the Second World War and completely forgotten afterwards. But very much the same idea of society should be led by poets, by artists, by, in a kind of aristocracy of creative talent.
Yes, I'm not sure that. I think Beethoven certainly considered artistic creativity to be the highest aspiration of humanity. Of course, that's convenient when that's what you do as your job, right? On the other hand, would he have believed in an aristocracy of artists? I think he probably knew too many artists to have believed that that could be workable. But we don't really know exactly what his thoughts were on that. We do know that he spoke out openly against the repressive governments of Austria in his day, mean, Beethoven was born in Bonn in the Rhineland in Germany, but spent almost his entire adult life in Vienna. And so all we know essentially is that he opposed tyranny and on the one hand, as I think I make clear in the book, he had tremendous enduring love for humanity in the abstract and tremendous contempt for most human beings individually.
We spoke of the individual, the romantic notion of the individual. The idea of the artist as hero also comes into being at this time, and Beethoven is the exemplar of that in some ways.
That's when we refer to, music historians tend to refer to three periods in Beethoven's creative output. The early period when he was still adhering largely to the forms of his predecessors, particularly Haydn, with whom he studied, and Mozart, with whom he had intended to study but who died a little too soon. And then we refer to the middle period, basically from around 1803, 1804. Beethoven, I should say, was born in 1770, so the early period goes into his early 30s. In the middle period, from his early to mid-30s into his early to mid-40s, when he created these sort of fist-shaking fate-defying works like the Third Eroica Symphony, the E-flat Symphony, the Fifth Symphony in C minor, of course, being the most famous of them all, to the especially to the general public, and so on and so forth. Also, a lot of his most tempestuous piano works, the string quartets. And so when we refer to that as Beethoven's heroic period, when he wrote these pieces that were meant to shake up musical form, as it was then known, to seriously broaden harmonic possibilities. The late period, the period of the Ninth Symphony, the Missa Solemnis, the last three piano sonatas, possibly the last two cello sonatas, and above all, the Diabelli variations and the last five string quartets. This is Beethoven's late period. It's his, what I would call his transcendent period, when he had gone beyond all of that and was aiming for something much more universal, what I describe as the universalizing of the intimate. He was taking what was deepest inside himself and transforming it into music that was meant to reach all human beings, he hoped, for many generations to come. And unfortunately, it hasn't reached all human beings, but it has lasted for many generations. And if we don't blow ourselves off the face of the earth, we'll probably last for many more generations.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with writer and music historian Harvey Sachs about his latest book, The Ninth, Beethoven and the World in 1824. This idea of posterity, I found that very interesting, that he was perhaps the first musician to be very conscious of his future place, of that he was leaving a legacy. And I wondered, what kind of shift in consciousness does it take to begin to think, you know, unlike Haydn and Mozart, who basically, you know, as you point out, wrote very much for their own time, what kind of shift in consciousness, or was it just something individual to Beethoven himself that could lead to this?
Well, first of all, there's the practical side of it. With the Industrial Revolution, there's the rise of the middle class. We all know about that. We've all learned about that. And among other things, the idea that larger and larger numbers of people could indulge in the, quote, finer things in life, unquote. So the pianos began to be built in ever-increasing numbers, and music publishing became a major industry because people played music in the home. You know, that was their home entertainment system of the early 19th century. So the fact that music publication became widespread was the basic factor. Yes, even Bach, who died in 1750, did publish some music within his own lifetime, but very limited amounts. Mozart and Haydn a little more, considerably more, actually. And they wanted their music to be published, but I don't think anybody at that time, until certainly the end of the 18th century, the beginning of the 19th century, had the notion that this music was going to endure much beyond their own lifetimes, except perhaps among a select circle of actual musicians who would be interested in it from a historical and educational point of view. I mean, we know that Beethoven himself grew up playing Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier, but it had not been published. He played from a manuscript copy that, you know, had been copied and copied and recopied and recopied by many, many people. So with Beethoven, it so happened that his time coincided with this greater and greater dissemination of music. And his idea became, also because he had a certain arrogance and I don't give a damn quality about him. If people are not interested in my music, that's their problem. He did want his music to be listened to and to be loved, obviously. But his feeling was, especially in his last years, that if this music is too difficult now, you know, for the public of today, someday people will be able to understand what I'm doing. Very few people were able to understand it in his day. I'm not talking about the early or middle period works, which were fairly quickly absorbed and on the whole well-received. But the late period works, there were not many people who really could figure out what in the world he was doing. The young Berlioz in Paris was one of the first musicians to catch on to the Ninth Symphony and to the late string quartets and so on, and to say, this is something unbelievable, this is something that we have to get to know because this is the most important music that's been written in our time. But, you know, by and large, it wasn't until a few decades after Beethoven's death that the late period works began to be generally well received. And even then, and even into the 20th century, one hears of, you know, musicians who had a hard time accepting the late period works. I'm thinking of Arthur Rubinstein. I did a biography of him years ago, and he said at one point in his memoirs, Joachim, one of the great violinists of the day, laughed at me because I fell asleep as a student when I was listening to his famous quartet perform Beethoven's Opus 131, the quartet in C sharp minor. And he said, and I still fall asleep when I listen to it. Well, to me, I'm two generations younger than Arthur Rubinstein, and I feel that Opus 131 it's kind of my desert island piece of music. That if I could only have one piece of music to listen to, that would probably be it.
I asked Harvey Sachs how Beethoven's Ninth was received at its debut.
The audience reacted actually very positively, but probably more because Beethoven was considered an old man at 53, and he was revered. He was the most revered composer in Europe, and he hadn't given a concert in a long time, and so he was very enthusiastically received. Given the fact that the performance must have been an almost complete shambles and disaster because of lack of rehearsal time, they were playing from manuscripts, which they couldn't read very well. Beethoven himself, although there were three different people conducting, he was one of them giving the beat and he couldn't hear. So the performance had to have been rather disastrous. But generally, the audience reacted very well. They cheered him. But some of the critics said, it's not that great. The reaction to the singers in particular was, one critic wrote, they did what they could, which kind of says it all.
And they hadn't had a whole lot of time to practice.
No, because there were no, we think, oh, good old days, Vienna, high culture. But that's not true at all. Things were much worse then than they are now. As far as symphonic music is concerned, there were no permanent orchestras then. So this was the orchestra that played the premiere of the Ninth Symphony was a theater orchestra that had been enlarged by players from other ensembles, some of whom were amateurs. The chorus was entirely made up of amateurs. The soloists, the lead soprano was, I believe, 19, and the contralto, or 20 maybe, and the contralto was 21. You know, these were not experienced, highly experienced people on the whole. And they not only had to play the Ninth Symphony, it was one of those gargantuan programs that people seemed to love in those days. They played three of the sections of the new Missa Solemnis of Beethoven and his overture to the Consecration of the House, which was not quite new, but was recent and quite difficult. So they had tremendous amount of music to perform. They apparently had only two ensemble rehearsals. And, it can only have been horrendous.
In your book, Harvey Sachs the Ninth, you also make a connection to other great individuals. During that time, you talk about Pushkin, Delacroix, Byron, Lord Byron, and Heinrich Heine, who I think stands somewhat in a category of his own. These romantic individuals, what was the connection that you make between their work and what they were doing and what Beethoven was doing in his Ninth Symphony?
I think they all felt, even Beethoven was the oldest by quite a bit of any of those, but I think they all felt the disillusion of the failure of the French Revolution and its principles, as I said, in the short run, in any case. And they felt the need to use artistic expression as a means of getting around, somehow or other, the political repression. The connections are very tenuous. They're not, none of these people, or few of them anyway, actually knew each other, and some of them didn't even know of each other. But there was Byron, just, less than 3 weeks before the premiere of the Ninth Symphony, who died at Missolonghi in Greece in his help, in his attempt to help the Greeks in their war of liberation against the Ottoman Empire. There was Pushkin in internal exile in Russia because of his liberal political statements. He had been sent away from St. Petersburg by the Tsar and sent to Odessa first and then to a remote estate in the north, Mikhailovskaya. Pushkin began writing his play Boris Godunov specifically about political repression, referring, of course, back 300 years so that he wasn't talking about the current rulers, but people made the connection. In fact, the Tsar didn't allow the play to be published uncensored in Pushkin's lifetime. Delacroix painted the massacres at Chios, which also was about the war, the Greeks' struggle for independence from the Turks. Heine, of course, as you say, is a very different kettle of fish. The connection there geographically is much closer because Heine and Beethoven were both from the Rhineland in Germany. They were born, I think, less than 40 miles apart. But Heine was a generation younger. He came from a middle-class Jewish family. Beethoven came from a very poor Catholic family. And Heine was an ironist, which Beethoven certainly was not. Heine was also directly interested in political events, in the political events of his day, which Beethoven was really only in a sort of peripheral way. But still, there is a spiritual connection there. Heine, of course, was one of the people who had no understanding of Beethoven's later works and was one of the people who said, poor guy was deaf, you know, he couldn't hear what he was doing, so we have to take pity on him because his music is unintelligible.
And Heine was, as you say, an ironist. It seems to me that that's a much more modern way of thinking than the romantic way of thinking.
Yeah, certainly, certainly. I mean, of course, you know, there are no... It's hard to put any of these people into categories. If you think of the Byron of Childe Harold, you know, you're getting the tempestuous romantic. But if you think of the Byron of Don Juan, you're getting an ironist there as much as Heine. And of course, Heine and Pushkin adored Byron's work. Also, Heine has a lot of purely romantic poetry as well as the ironic and self-ironic works that he wrote.
Another aspect of romanticism is kind of the belief in a transcendent truth, I think. You know, the sense that there is this hidden, this inner essence that is not visible to the world. In this way, it really contrasts with the kind of rationalism that perhaps was born in the Enlightenment and has come down today in, I think, some of the struggles between science and spirituality or science and religion. I wonder if any of that came into some of your thinking as you were working on this book, The Ninth.
Certainly. I mean, Beethoven himself was born a Catholic and baptized. He did not practice any religion in his adult life, but he certainly believed in some higher power. He was probably a sort of pantheist. We know that he was also interested in Eastern religions and Eastern philosophy, which was very unusual for his day, and probably he got that through his reading of Goethe. But he went on to read on his own whatever was available then in German or French on those subjects. So certainly his feeling, and this is communicated also in the words from Schiller's text that he used in the Ninth Symphony, talking about a father who lives above the canopy of the stars. It's a sort of godlike image, but it isn't specifically connected to any particular religion. He believed undoubtedly that there was some sort of force that connected human beings and the planets and everything else all together in a cosmic way, but he didn't have any orthodox religious beliefs.
Harvey Sachs, your book is The Ninth, Beethoven and the World in 1824. I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Harvey Sachs is the author of 8 previous books, including biographies of Arturo Toscanini and Arthur Rubinstein. He teaches at the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia. Next up, Mark Lamster on another heroic figure of the arts, Peter Paul Rubens. We air an archived interview with him from March 2010. Don't go away. Thank you. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When we think of the Flemish artist Pieter Paul Rubens, most of us call up visions of amply endowed naked women and plump cherubs cavorting on a massive canvas. Rubens was the most sought-after painter of his time for the major and minor royalty of Europe. He was a shrewd businessman who levered his career as an artist into fabulous wealth. But he also had a hidden career as a secret diplomat for the Spanish crown. His hometown was Antwerp in Flanders. Along with Holland, Flanders was part of the Low Countries, at that time colonies of Spain. And while Flanders was a docile colony, Holland was in the throes of a revolt against colonial rule. When the Dutch blockaded Antwerp, they choked off the vital artery of commerce that fed Flanders' prosperity. Rubens wanted peace. He spent years trying to broker a peace deal for Spain, playing the great diplomatic game between the European powers. He didn't live to see peace come, but the story of his efforts affords a fascinating window into the history of his time and the character of Rubens, a charismatic, pragmatic, artistic genius. Mark Lamster has written that story. His book is Master of Shadows, The Secret Diplomatic Career of Pieter Paul Rubens. I have to say, first of all, that Rubens has never been one of my favorite painters. A little too Baroque for me. But I have a far greater appreciation of him now, after having read your book, than I ever did before then. And I don't think I'm alone in this. I think Rubens, you know, seen as one of the greatest masters of his time, during his time, has no longer been seen that way. Why did that happen?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I think Rubens is one of these painters who's a little bit hidden in plain sight. We think of Rubens, we think of, you know, fat, naked women, basically, and those aren't so fashionable these days. And also, when we think of Rubens, his paintings, they're these huge canvases. They have mythological and allegorical and biblical subjects. And I think modern audiences just have a hard time understanding those. We don't really know those subjects so well anymore. We're not as familiar with that kind of language anymore. So we have a tendency to look at them just in purely formal terms. They're confusing, they're big, and we kind of say, oh, Rubens, he's great, and we kind of move on to the next thing in the gallery. And I think there's also an aspect of Rubens' life where he was this sort of very bourgeois gentleman and not a romantic figure like, say, Caravaggio or Rembrandt or Van Gogh or Jackson Pollock. Say, I think we think about artists as these romantic, dangerous, self-destructive types. And Rubens never fell into that convention. He was a very successful businessman. He was a very stable family man, a kind of model gentleman. And that, in a way, was what allowed him to be so successful, both as a painter and as a diplomat. But in a way, it's, I think, thrown up a wall between him and modern audiences who sort of look for something else when they look for great painting.
He was a very stable bourgeois gentleman. On the other hand, he came from not quite so stable a family. There was a bit of scandal in the background of his family. Tell us about that.
Yes, well, his father was a very successful lawyer and alderman in Antwerp, Flanders, modern Belgium. And at the time, Flanders sort of dissolved. There was a wars of religion in the Low Countries at that time. And for various reasons, the Rubens family was forced to flee Antwerp and their homeland. And Rubens' father wound up in Germany, and he became involved with the wife of William of Orange, who was sort of the George Washington of Holland, and had this extramarital affair with her, which was discovered. They had a child together, and this was a capital offense. So Rubens' father spent several years in prison and basically decimated the family's fortunes with his philandering behavior. And I think Rubens knew about this. This all happened before he was born, but he was well aware of the family history. And I think that sort of pushed him to be a more stable figure in his adult life. He learned the lessons of his father's behavior.
Now, what you've just said just shows how incredibly intertwined families were that were on different sides of the political struggles. You talked about William of Orange of Holland. I'm sure most of our listeners know very little, if they know anything at all, about the history that Holland at this time was under the control, was a colony of Spain, and that Antwerp and Rubens himself was an ally of the Spanish against the Dutch. Tell us, if you can, in, you know, sketch out for us this history.
Right. Well, in the 16th century, the entire Low Countries, what we know today as Belgium and Holland, was a possession of Spain. And the Dutch rebelled against some very harsh Spanish rule. The Low Countries at that time were kind of like the Iraq of the 17th century and the 16th century, shall we say. Sort of this land divided by sectarian violence with this negligent foreign occupier, and that would be Spain. And Holland revolted against Spain, and Flanders, or modern Belgium, basically remained loyal. So what happened was that Flanders, where Rubens was from, became the sort of the theater of battle between Spain and Holland, who were having this prolonged war, what we now know as the 80 Years' War. This was a critical war. Spain was not concerned just with losing Holland, but because Holland had developed into this great maritime power, it was an existential threat for Spain, because Spain depended on its colonies all around the world to support its empire. And here was Holland fighting it basically around the world. This was really, the 80 Years' War was the first global war, the first world war. They were fighting in Africa, South America, North America, Asia, the subcontinent, East Asia. Really, everywhere there were men, they were fighting, in addition to Europe. So this was a conflict that Rubens became engaged in. And really, he devoted a decade of his life to try and end this war, because it was brutal for Antwerp, which really sat on the front lines in Europe of this war.
In fact, there was a case there where you talk about in the book, and I have to say, this is a fascinating book, Master of Shadows, The Secret Diplomatic Career of the Painter Peter Paul Rubens. Now, let's get to Rubens. First of all, he's a painter. How did he get into a position, as he did here, as being the secret diplomat, trying to broker a peace, and I'm going to ask you who he tried to broker a peace with, trying to create alliances in favor of Spain's empire in the Low Countries?
Because Rubens was such a popular painter among monarchs of Europe, he became a sort of perfect covert agent for the Spanish crown and for the sovereigns of Flanders. Basically, he was traveling all over the world. He was traveling to foreign capitals, and wherever he was meeting with figures in the highest, at the highest level of state. So he was very well positioned to not only conduct secret behind doors affairs, but also to report back on the things that he'd seen, sort of as a spy, essentially. And in fact, he was enlisted as a spy. He was on the military payroll of the Flemish government, and as he became more and more trusted by his sovereigns, he was entrusted with more and more important affairs, until eventually he was negotiating treaties.
He was a pretty remarkable guy, too. I mean, talk a little bit about his personality. He was widely respected, and in fact, you could almost say he was a kind of charismatic figure, perhaps not charismatic in the sense of a military leader, but in a more quiet way.
He was a charismatic figure. People were naturally attracted to him. He was an incredibly bright person. You know, we talk about Renaissance men, and this was the Baroque era, but he was most certainly a Renaissance man. He could do many, many things, and many things at once. He was interested in science, in the arts, obviously. He wrote about architecture. He wrote about natural sciences. He was a classical scholar. He was very much involved in the intellectual life of Flanders, of Antwerp, but also of Europe in its entirety. And wherever he went, sort of people wanted to be around him because, you know, he was this great painter and people liked him. And he had a reputation for being a man who was trustworthy and knowledgeable. and sort of a node on this network of humanist intellectuals around Europe. That made him very a prized person when he came to visit any foreign capital.
And he knew a lot about diplomacy. He actually studied it. You talk about Machiavelli a lot. Give us a little bit about the time frame here. Would he have known of Machiavelli?
He did. He had read Machiavelli. He was a voracious reader, and especially about the things that directly pertain to his business. He read constantly about politics and diplomacy. Whenever a book came out about diplomacy in Paris or elsewhere, he would hear about it. He would make sure a copy was sent to him so he could read it. And he, in fact, consulted on a work of diplomacy written by a Brussels-based diplomat. So he was very well-versed in diplomatic theory, and also, of course, could back that up with his own personal experience in diplomatic practice.
A question that I had in reading the book, and we're talking about the book Master of Shadows, The Secret Diplomatic Career of the Painter Peter Paul Rubens, with my guest Mark Lamster, the author. A question I had in reading this book is, why was a man of such breadth of learning on the side of the colonial power rather than on the side, perhaps, of the Dutch?
Well, Rubens was a very moderate and pragmatic figure, but he was also a conservative person. His mode of changing a society was to reform it from within rather than to attack it from without. So just by virtue of where he came from and his own personal family history, it was, and his religious beliefs, it was natural that he would be loyal to Spain. Although he was very disappointed and constantly aggravated by the behavior of the Spanish crown. But he felt the best way to find peace and to move forward was not to sort of try and fight that power, but to try and reform that power from within, to try and bring peace to these fighting powers rather than create more conflict.
And it was an incredibly complicated dance that he tried to do. Ultimately, his goal was to make peace with Holland because Antwerp was so disadvantaged in this. As long as this struggle was going on, in fact, in a way that the port traffic was blockaded. Maybe you could explain that. But in order to do that, he had to go through Britain. Tell us a story.
Well, Antwerp again sits on the front lines of this war between Spain and Holland. It's right at the border or near the border between what is now Belgium and what is now Holland. So it was right near where the fighting was and always in some danger. And Antwerp sits on the River Scheldt, and that's its economic lifeline. It empties into the North Sea, and the Dutch Navy had basically cut it off. It was just devastating for the Flemish homeland. So Rubens needed to figure out a way to sort of resolve this conflict, and he settled on this way of sort of this triangular diplomatic approach. I like to call it like the transitive theory of diplomacy. And his idea was that if he could make Spain an ally of England, then England, which was naturally allied with Holland, would force Holland to become allied with Spain, and that would end this war. So he undertook this basically decade-long effort to bring Spain and England to peace, and this was no small task. If you recall that Spain and England had been enemies, vicious enemies, for decades, and is still there remains hostility between the two countries. And, you know, the Spanish Armada was sunk by the British Navy in 1588. So there's a long history of conflict there. And he managed to actually get these two powers to come to peace. It's almost like, you know, the United States and the Soviet Union coming to peace. They were really superpowers and opposed superpowers. And he managed to bring them to the table. It was an extraordinary accomplishment. It did not, in the end, result in the peace that he had ultimately hoped for, which was between Holland and Spain. But just by itself, it was quite a considerable coup.
So let's talk a little bit now about the art. As you mentioned, that Rubens produced a cycle, a very famous cycle of paintings for Maria de' Medici. Also, of course, he did for the King of Spain. He did for the Pope as well. I mean, all the greats of Europe, the King of England, for that matter. Tell us about how the art and the politics intertwined here in furthering Rubens' ambitions, both as a painter as well as a diplomat.
As a painter, Rubens had access to major figures in the political world because they so enjoyed his paintings. And he could also send messages with his paintings about the nature of war, the nature of politics. Whether those were received or not depended on the circumstance. And oftentimes he was in a precarious position with Marie de Medici, who he, as we discussed, painted this long cycle about. She had led this very difficult, not especially wonderful life. And here he was stuck trying to celebrate it in an entire series of canvases of great scale. And that was a serious challenge because she hadn't done so many wonderful things. And in fact, there were a lot of, it was basically a political minefield for what he could and could not paint. In fact, the pictures ended up being quite abstract in many ways. What exactly was happening in some of them was really obscure, so that you could kind of interpret them however you wanted.
Give us an example.
A great example from the Medici cycle would be one of the paintings called The Felicity of Her Regency. It was actually a replacement for another picture that was deemed inappropriate. And here, Marie, who is not an especially attractive woman, was painted as this beautiful goddess-like figure, naked at the breast, surrounded by these figures supporting her. And it was just a patently ridiculous proposition. But also kind of a fantastic painting.
So Rubens definitely knew how to flatter his clients.
There was no one better at sort of presenting clients the way they wanted to be seen rather than the way they were. He had a way of appealing to figures of great power, figures who ruled by divine right, that made them especially comfortable and appealed to their native sense of grandeur and power.
Well, I'm talking with Mark Lamster. He's the author of Master of Shadows. It's about the secret diplomatic career of the painter Peter Paul Rubens. Rubens actually became a member of the nobility himself, born a commoner. How common was this, and how did this happen?
Well, it happened not that unusually. Rubens became so amazingly wealthy that he was actually worth more than many of the nobles who were basically protesting his elevation to that status or looked unkindly upon him. He was elevated to the nobility essentially because diplomatic work was really the work of the aristocracy. And it was difficult for him to conduct political affairs as a commoner. And it became essentially a political expedience for him to have his status raised, which was essentially the reason why the Spanish king elevated his position, also out of gratitude for his work and because he was such a distinguished figure. And then, so he was first elevated to nobility in Spain, and then Charles I, the King of England, also granted him a title of nobility as a matter of gratitude because he so admired him. Charles I really, really, really admired Rubens. In fact, he asked Rubens to supply him with a self-portrait, that is, Rubens would paint himself and send it to the king. Rubens at first didn't even want to do this. He thought that was inappropriate that a commoner would send a self-portrait to a king, especially from another land. He thought that was a strange, weird request. And then actually Charles hung it outside his bedroom so he could look at it all the time, which was definitely weird.
Why do you think Charles liked him so much?
Well, Charles, for its own reasons, was especially interested in art and was especially interested in raising the status of his own court. And one of the ways he did that was by sort of this art patronage program that would elevate the status of his dynasty to the level of the dynasties in in Madrid, in Paris, in Rome, in Florence. And there was really no better painter in the world than Rubens. So it was kind of a natural attraction.
So I want to ask you about doing the research on this. I'm sure most of this history is more or less known in some way. I mean, you weren't doing like deep archival research.
The hard thing about Rubens isn't so much discovering new material. It's assimilating the enormous catalog of material that's been written, that's been generated, you know, in 400 years of history. I don't think any painter has been written about with such frequency as Rubens, because he has all these different aspects of his life. He's appealed to historians for generation after generation after generation. He's left a long track record of correspondence. So there's just an enormous amount of material. And I think the challenge of any writer is to take all that material and distill a story from it that is true to that history, but also is compelling as a story, as a narrative in its own right.
And this story that you tell certainly is compelling. Yet, in spite of all this work that's been done, would you say that outside of maybe academia that there's been... this was new to me, in other words, I guess I'm saying, and I don't know if it was new to me just because I was ignorant, or whether, you know, when you say the secret diplomatic career, this is not very well known that he was really involved, not in a general sense.
No, I think people don't know it. I mean, I think people, first of all, just don't know Rubens that well, just because he's so hard and difficult. I think art historians tend to look at his diplomatic work as ancillary, not really a central aspect of his artistic career, and sort of they mention it or talk about it briefly, but it's not primarily what they're interested in writing about. And political historians have a tendency to gloss over this whole period to begin with. And because the treaties that Rubens negotiated sort of fell by the wayside, and Spain was in the end the loser in history of this period, his accomplishments have been neglected. So in a way, he's managed to fall through the cracks in both disciplines, which is a shame. I think to understand his painting, maybe you don't need to understand the political history, but it becomes so much richer. The work becomes so much more powerful when you understand this period and what he was working on in the background, because political affairs are so much a part of what he was doing. They're sometimes a subtext, and sometimes they are the direct subject of his work. And to really appreciate that, I think you need a little bit of that context. And once you have it, it opens up this painter who's hidden in plain sight, shall we say. And we have some of the richest, most powerful works in the history of art, and they just open up to you. To me, that was one of the reasons to write this book.
In reading this book, I kept on thinking about modern parallels, particularly the cost of war to empire and how empires fall. You mentioned the word pragmatist before. He was pragmatic. Of course, that's a word that's being used a lot to describe President Obama. Could you talk a little bit about some of the lessons that you drew from this history? When you were done with the book, what did you come up with in terms of what we could take away from this for today?
Well, one of the reasons I started writing it was because I felt like the story was so resonant with current affairs. I started writing it at the time the Iraq war was burning at its hottest and seemed most intractable. And this story of a land divided by sectarian violence with a foreign occupier that was quite negligent seemed especially pertinent. And Antwerp actually had all these parallels with Baghdad. It was one of the few cities that had a green zone. The Spanish occupying force actually had built the citadel adjacent to Antwerp to defend themselves from the natives of Antwerp. And if you think about it, this is an incredibly unusual architectural typology. Normally, a city builds a citadel to protect itself from foreigners. Here, from foreign invaders. Here, the foreign invaders had built the citadel to protect themselves from the natives. So you kind of couldn't help but sort of see the parallels between them. And I think as you just study history, the more you see how it becomes more and more relevant. I think, you know, during the presidential election, this we were talking about whether we should or should not be negotiating with Iran, this idea of is continuous negotiation fruitful or not fruitful. And I think one of the great lessons of this book and of this period was that you always keep your channels of negotiation open because you never know. History can change on a dime, and or situations can change on a dime. You never know when your history, when your enemy is going to become your friend, and it's necessary to always have your channels open. And this was Rubens's enemies felt this. Rubens felt this. Actually, Richelieu actually wrote an entire chapter of his Testament Politique, his sort of a model, a treatise on how to behave diplomatically. There was an entire section on the art of continuous negotiation. So it was sort of a held political belief that you constantly negotiated with your foes or at least talked to them. So I think there are constantly similarities between that period and this period. And here we have Rubens, this really pragmatic, moderate figure trying to reform a society from within. And to me, that has resonance with the current administration.
First, I know Goya's horrors of war, but Rubens also painted a horrors of war. Tell us about that painting. And also, you said that Goya might very well have been influenced by it directly.
Well, Rubens was one of the most generative artists in the world. He influenced painters year after year after year. And the consequences of war is a painting that its imagery has been recycled again and again and again because it's so powerful. It's about the consequences of destruction, of man's choice to have conflict and what it means. And we see one of Rubens' most beautiful nudes, a Venus, in the center of this painting, trying to restrain an angry Mars. And we can see on the ground figures stepping on books, and you know, architecture is endangered, is being crushed. There is a protractor. There's symbols of what this calamity means. There's a figure representing Europe screaming, and it's an incredibly powerful, moving painting that's influenced generations and generations of artists.
And something that he would have, it would have been very heartfelt for him to have painted this.
Yes, he painted this in a period after he had negotiated this treaty between England and Spain, and even after that, a sort of conflict had reignited, and the world was not learning lessons that he had hoped it would have learned about pragmatic, peaceful solutions to problems. He had, at that point, essentially washed his hands of politics. He was frustrated and sort of returned to his studio, and then this was sort of one of his final masterpieces.
Well, Mark Lamster, thanks so much for joining us here and talking to us about your fascinating book. It's a terrific read, Master of Shadows, The Secret Diplomatic Career of the Painter Peter Paul Rubens.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Go to writersvoice.net to find out more about Mark Lamster. Next week, we find out why the Senate failed to pass climate legislation. We talk with Businessweek editor Eric Pooley about his terrific, true political thriller, The Climate War. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.